Welcome to the debate. Usually, when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's a really clear expectation of, well, precision. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line in the bone, and the doctor just points to it and says, you know, there it is.
Right. It's entirely binary. The bone is broken or it isn't.
Exactly.
And we naturally gravitate toward that kind of clarity. We want our problems to be visible, to be neatly categorized, and ideally, to have a linear solution.
We really do. But then you step into the world of human psychology, or neurodevelopment, or complex trauma, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just completely useless. We find ourselves looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky.
Yeah, you're dealing with the invisible connective tissue of human experience.
Right, exactly. And that space where conceptual precision fails us, where you can't just point to a fracture on a screen, is exactly the terrain we are exploring today. We are diving into a recently published academic white paper by Dr. Bichara Sahali. It's dated May 30, 2026, and it's titled The Poetics of Life Coherence: Beauty, Ritual, Grief, and the Temple of Living Worlds.
And it is a fascinating, really dense piece of work.
Oh, it really is. The foundational premise is profound. The framework argues that life coherence, which it defines as the preservation, restoration, and expansion of our capacity to truly live, it can't be transmitted through concepts or arguments alone.
No, you can't just, you know, hand someone a spreadsheet.
Right. You can't hand them a theoretical framework of how to live and expect them to just magically embody it. It requires what the paper calls a poetic transmission layer. It has to be felt. It has to move through beauty, through shared ritual, through the processing of grief, and the actual tempo of how we act in the world.
Because human beings just do not live by argument alone. I mean, we recognize truth through the tone of a voice or the rhythm of a shared meal or, you know, how a community holds silence after a tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we rely strictly on concepts and data, we end up in what this framework calls life blindness. We become entirely disconnected from the actual pulse of living things.
But this brings us to the central tension we are unpacking today. If life coherence absolutely requires this poetic layer, how is that layer practically achieved in a modern society?
Right, that's the big question.
Must a life-coherent civilization actively design, structure, and institutionalize these poetic forms? Meaning, you know, we intentionally build rituals, we structure our knowledge commons, we create explicit protocols? Or does the framework's heavy emphasis on non-forcing action, the concept of wu-wei, suggest that true coherence can only emerge organically when we withdraw institutional force and just stop trying to engineer outcomes?
I will be arguing that any attempt to systematize or engineer poetics, well, it fundamentally misunderstands the concept. It risks creating dead ritual. And I really believe true coherence is basically about attunement and the highly disciplined withdrawal of force.
And I will be taking the position that this framework actively demands the intentional cultivation and structural integration of poetic vessels. If we want to survive modern fragmentation, we must deliberately reorganize our cultural physiology.
Okay, but
let me just start by laying out exactly why intentional architecture is so crucial. We live in a modern world that defaults to extraction, acceleration, and fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
If we just step back and, you know, let things emerge organically, what emerges is the default mechanical baseline of the attention economy. We get algorithmic capture, we get isolation. We need to combat modern life blindness actively.
But forcing a structure isn't the antidote to extraction, is it?
It isn't forcing, it's physiology. There is this brilliant concept in the framework that describes ritual as cultural physiology. Think about it. A biological body requires a highly structured, deliberately evolved physiological system to regulate its internal transitions.
Sure.
Your heart doesn't just, you know, organically decide how to pump blood. It relies on a rigorous, established architecture. Similarly, a civilization requires deliberately maintained structured rituals to survive major thresholds, things like birth, conflict, apology, and death.
I hear you, but...
And just to finish the thought, The detailed architectures provided in this text, like the specific navigational pathways of a knowledge commons and the literal inclusion of a life-coherent publishing checklist, they prove that life coherence demands rigorous, intentional design. It is an active build, not passive observation.
I just fundamentally disagree with that interpretation of the framework. And I think we need to look closely at the concept of Wu Wei to understand why.
Okay.
When we talk about Wu Wei, we are not talking about passively doing nothing. The text defines it beautifully as doing nothing extra. It is the disciplined refusal to add what is called coercive miscoupling.
Coercive miscoupling?
Right. Think of it like trying to mandate genuine vulnerability through a mandatory corporate team-building retreat.
Oh, yeah. Those are terrible.
Exactly. Because it inherently rejects the forcing. You are smashing two incompatible systems together. My position is that you cannot engineer the poetics of life. The moment an institution tries to design beauty or structurally administer a space for grief, you cross over into the temporal violence this framework warns against.
Temporal violence?
Yeah. Temporal violence is forcing a natural living process into a mechanical spreadsheet schedule. The strongest mandate here isn't building structures. It is protecting the margins. It's allowing life to emerge at its own tempo, what it calls living time, rather than forcing it into an architectural framework.
I hear the hesitation about bureaucracy. I really do. But if we agree that we are crossing profound thresholds, birth, illness, ecological loss, how do individuals survive those passages without a shared form?
Well, they...
A threshold is a state where the old form of life no longer holds and the new one hasn't stabilized. It's incredibly dangerous. Yes, dead ritual is a risk, but the absence of ritual guarantees fragmentation. The absence of ritual does not make a society rational. It makes it numb.
I wouldn't say numb.
Let me offer a way to look at this. If a living system is like a garden, as the text suggests, a garden doesn't just spontaneously flourish by leaving the soil alone. It requires the active arrangement of paths, the deliberate provision of shade, the turning of the earth. Ritual is the necessary trellis that allows the vine of a community to grow upward. If you don't build the trellis, the vine just rots on the ground.
I see the appeal of the garden analogy, but wait, a trellis is inanimate.
Sure.
We're talking about human beings and human emotions. A trellis doesn't care how fast the vine grows, but when you institutionalize a human ritual, you impose chronos over kairos. We have to distinguish between the two.
Okay, let's do that.
Chronos is the ticking clock on the wall. It's mechanical, standardized time. Kairos is the right or opportune moment, the natural season of a human process. When an institution takes over a ritual, it inevitably relies on chronos.
Not always.
It does. It says, we will hold a 2-hour reconciliation seminar, or HR allows exactly 3 days of bereavement leave. You are demanding that the vine grow exactly 3 inches by Tuesday.
Well, that's just bad management.
No, that is the tyranny of acceleration. A living ritual restores relation because it moves at the speed of kairos. The moment an institution orchestrates it to manage a transition, it becomes a performance of belonging while leaving the actual emotional abandonment completely intact.
Look, I don't think the structure itself is the violence. The rigid mechanical application of it is. You need a vessel to hold the water. And if we agree that physical spaces like a community garden or a physical grieving space require some form of vessel, the real crisis of our era isn't even physical. It's digital.
Mm-hmm.
How do you build a trellis for human attention when the internet is actively trying to tear it down? This is where the intentional design becomes undeniable. Look at the digital rituals of shared knowledge. How do we transmit life coherence at scale without it just becoming algorithmic noise?
Well, I don't think a checklist is the answer.
But the framework describes the knowledge commons not merely as a data repository, but as a poetic vessel. It is a highly intentional architecture. There are white papers designed for deep, slow, conceptual study. There are podcasts meant for listening while moving through the physical world. There are visual master diagrams for immediate intuition. This is a carefully designed ecology,
it requires an architect.
But an architect implies control over how the space is consumed, and I just don't buy that the architecture is the focal point of the coherence.
Really? It's explicitly outlined.
Yes, but let's look at the appendix of this very framework. There is a life coherent publishing checklist, a literal 10-point pre-publication checklist.
I think it's brilliant.
It asks the author to verify things like, you know, is this beautiful enough to invite attention? And is it humble enough not to dominate? Let me tell you exactly why that proves the danger of your position. Attempting to codify profound human virtues like humility and beauty into a bureaucratic checklist is a massive contradiction.
Is it, though?
Yes. It risks turning life coherence into the exact mechanical forcing the framework claims to dismantle. You cannot mandate poetics. You cannot verify humility by ticking a box on a web form before uploading a PDF. Checklists are the tools of platforms and bureaucracies, optimized for capture, not living ecologies.
I think you are viewing that checklist entirely through the lens of corporate compliance rather than through the lens of, say, monastic discipline.
Monastic discipline? Come on.
No, really. If you're listening to this on your commute and you're thinking about your overflowing inbox or your social media feed, think about what the act of publishing online actually looks like today. You type something up, you hit upload, a progress bar fills for half a second, and your thought is instantly injected into the digital ether.
True. It's fast.
It is completely frictionless. It is thoughtless. By placing a checklist at that exact threshold, what is actually happening? Friction is being deliberately inserted.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but...
When a creator has to literally pause their workflow and ask, does this piece of media respect the living time of the reader? They are engaging in a civilizational micropractice. It's an act of consecration. The repetition, the slow care with the metadata, the deliberate linking back to sources, these are the modern ceremonies of transmission. Recurrence and discipline are the only things that prevent a commons from just another captured platform.
I understand the desire for friction. I do. But have you considered that a checklist fundamentally implies a definitive endpoint?
How so?
A checklist psychologically tells the user, once these 10 boxes are ticked, coherence has been achieved. I have done the work. But the underlying argument of life coherence is that it is never final. It is maintained through ongoing relation, continuous repair, and dynamic response.
Well, sure, it's an ongoing practice.
But my deep worry is that when we formalize the poetics into a workflow, we create an illusion of control. We start believing that because we followed the life coherent protocol, our output is inherently life-serving. We stop feeling the room and start relying on the protocol.
But without the protocol, without that repeated, structured practice, you just have chaos. You have the default internet. The text explicitly states, a life-coherent civilization is not one that abolishes ritual. It renews it. The checklist is a renewed ritual for the digital age. It is how we physically embody the intention to not contribute to the noise. You need the architecture to remind you to breathe.
Let's test this idea of control and architecture against the ultimate threshold, dying in grief.
Okay, let's go there.
If the digital commons is how we share knowledge of life, then how we handle finitude is the ultimate test of whether that knowledge actually works. The exploration of life-coherent dying completely solidifies my thesis about Wu Wei and restraint. Why does modern medicine become so deeply incoherent?
Because it prioritizes cure over care?
Because it treats death as a physiological engineering problem. It just hasn't been solved yet. It becomes incoherent specifically because it cannot stop intervening. It forces mechanical time onto a biological ending.
I agree with that.
The framework defines proper accompaniment as presence without domination. To me, this proves that life coherence is ultimately about restraint. Think of accompaniment like trying to catch a falling leaf. If you snatch at it out of the air, you crush it. You are forcing an outcome.
That's a beautiful image.
True accompaniment is placing your open hand underneath and simply letting it land at its own speed. It is knowing when to stop the clinical pathway, when to turn off the machines, and let living time take over.
I agree entirely that the confusion between curing and caring is where modern medicine loses its soul.
The drive to continuously engineer a cure up until the last breath is a form of temporal violence.
But we have to look closely at what actually replaces that drive.
Restraint.
The text makes a crucial distinction. Cure may end, care must not. Accompaniment is not passive observation. It is not just standing in an empty room letting nature take its course. Palliative care is highly active.
Well, active in a different way. Very active. When you pull back the medical machinery, you don't step into a void. You replace the IV lines with the architecture of care. You actively treat the breathlessness. You adjust the lighting. You wash the body. You deliberately guide the family through the biological realities of what is happening so they aren't terrified.
Mm-hmm.
How does that change the psychological environment of the room? It shifts the locus of control from the disease back to the person. That is not the absence of action. It's a profound shift in the type of structured intervention. It proves once again that coherence requires deliberate, highly skilled action. You are actively constructing a field of dignity.
You manage symptoms, yes, but you stop trying to engineer the outcome. That is the core of doing nothing extra. You stop turning the dying body into a battlefield. I would argue you aren't constructing a field of dignity. You are finally stepping back so the inherent dignity of the person can occupy the space it always had.
But that stepping back requires a structure to support it.
And we see this even more clearly in the aftermath, with grief. Grief is described as love encountering finitude. It's the physiological reality of what happens when love can no longer be held in the same physical way. What does a life-blind world do? It rushes the grief.
Right.
It tells the mourner to move on. It forces mechanical Chronos onto a living wound. A life-coherent world simply makes room for the truth. It refuses premature closure. That requires an immense amount of unforcing. It requires us to stop trying to fix the mourner.
But making room for the truth requires a container. It requires physical and cultural space. You cannot just leave a grieving person alone in their apartment and call it Wu Wei. Mourning rituals, memorials, anniversaries, these are explicitly listed in the text as necessary. They are ways of preventing loss from becoming violence.
Yes, but...
You have to actively build the memorial, you have to organize the gathering, you have to sing the lament. Grief might be a completely organic, unforced emotion. But the processing of it requires a cultural skeletal structure. Without those structures, grief becomes privatized. It becomes pathologized by society, and ultimately it returns as numbness or rage. You have to build the vessel so the grief can be distributed among the community.
Look, I don't disagree that songs are sung and gatherings happen, but a lament emerges organically from a broken heart. It isn't assigned by a committee. The tone of a culture isn't legislated. When we talk about worlds that teach us how to live, a world teaches through its atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the exploration of childhood in the paper. A child is described as coherence and formation. How do they learn trust? Through the unstructured rhythm of the home. How do they learn wonder? Through entirely unstructured play.
Right.
Play is explicitly defined as one of childhood's natural forms of Wu Wei, non-forcing learning. You protect the margins around the child so they can play. You don't choreograph their imagination. You don't put their wonder on a rubric.
But protecting those margins is a fierce, structural act. We are not living in a neutral vacuum. In a world of digital commodification, algorithmic capture, and hyper-competitive education systems, preserving a space for unstructured play requires intentional, architectural defense.
I mean, sure, you defend the space.
You have to actively build the walls of the garden to keep the attention economy out. You have to deliberately limit screen time, carefully choose the physical environment, and structure the family schedule to allow for that empty time. The mandate to conserve worlds in which children can belong is an active, ongoing, systematic effort. You cannot conserve a forest just by hoping the loggers don't show up. You have to draw a boundary and enforce it.
Conservation, absolutely. But conservation is about protecting what is already alive, not manufacturing life from scratch. And I think this is where we actually find our common ground. We completely agree on the diagnosis, the tyranny of acceleration, the prevalence of temporal violence, and the deep life blindness of our institutions are actively degrading our capacity to perceive beauty and process grief.
I couldn't agree more with that.
We both agree with the fundamental premise that human beings cannot live by concepts alone. But my synthesis of this material remains that life coherence is fundamentally an exercise in attunement and restraint. It demands that we recognize living time, kairos. It demands that we actively resist the modern impulse to engineer, to checklist, to mandate, and to force outcomes. The highest form of care, whether at the bedside or in a digital ecosystem, is often knowing exactly when to stop.
And my synthesis is that because we live in a world that defaults to extraction, life coherence requires us to actively build and rigorously maintain the poetic vessels. We need the rituals, we need the structured knowledge commons, and we need the deliberately constructed protective margins for childhood. Without the trellis, the vine falls back into the dirt of the attention economy. We must actively make right relation livable through careful design.
You know, sitting with both of these perspectives, perhaps the tension between our two views is the point.
Yeah.
The tension between designing life coherent structures and practicing non-forcing action might be exactly the dynamic that keeps a civilization awake. If we only rely on organic emergence, we might be devoured by the default forces of extraction. But if we over-engineer our defenses, we create dead ritual and bureaucratic sterility. The ongoing negotiation between the two is where actual living judgment resides.
I think that is a deeply clarifying point of convergence. The framework itself requires both the rigid architecture of the vessel and the unforced breath that moves through it. I highly encourage everyone listening to seek out Dr. Saheli's white paper, The Poetics of Life Coherence. Read it slowly, let it challenge you, and deeply consider what rhythms you are forcing or conserving in your own daily life.
It will absolutely change how you look at your own transitions and perhaps make you much more sensitive to the temporal violence we all accidentally commit against ourselves and others when we are, you know, just rushing.
Exactly. Which brings us right back to where we started. The X-ray machine is broken. We cannot simply point to a fractured bone on a screen and fix it with a standardized cast. We are operating in the murky, beautiful, highly complex waters of living relation. And in those waters, we don't just need a cleaner diagnosis. We need to learn how to swim together.
Well said.
Thank you for joining us for another rigorous exchange. Until next time.